way. We're going to be talking about that with our first guest. I'm very excited to have Rick Tilt joining me on the Green Front today. Also going to be talking about the wildfires burning in Colorado and New Mexico, all the weather reports and news networks covering that. But has anyone connected the dots? Nope, not really. Not even Ann Thompson, NBC's environmental correspondent, mentioned anything about the fact that climate change could be contributing to this very dry, windy, hot and fiery weather. In our second half, we're going to be talking about our most impactful behaviors, what makes the biggest difference in terms of our energy footprint. Very excited to be talking to John Rogers. He's a senior clean energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, talking about a book they just put out called Cooler Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. And that's a really great, helpful book because it they really analyze what, you know, we do that makes the biggest you know, difference in terms of reducing our footprint. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. We'll also be talking about some green myths, some things you may thought you knew, but in fact, they found that they don't make such a big difference. You can worry less about those bananas from Ecuador and worry a little bit more about what vehicle you're driving to Whole Foods to buy those bananas, the banana split, I call it, local or organic. And those are the kinds of things we'll be discussing with John. But first, I am welcoming to the show my co-host, D.R. Tucker, and also Rick Piltz. Rick Piltz, for those of you who don't recognize the name, is the founder and director of Climate Science Watch, a nonprofit public interest advocacy project dedicated to holding public officials accountable for using climate research with integrity and effectiveness in dealing with the challenge of global climactic disruption, which we are seeing a lot of right now. And during his more than 20 years in Washington, D.C., Rick's primary focus has been on the collision of climate science with the reality of climate politics and policy. Between 1995 and 2005, he held senior positions in the Coordination Office of the U.S. Global Change Research Program, and that multi-agency $2 billion program through which the federal government coordinates support for research on climate and global environmental change. He developed and edited 8 editions of Our Changing Planet, the program's widely distributed annual report to Congress. In the spring of 2005, Rick resigned from the Federal Climate Research Program to protest the Bush administration's political interference with climate change communication. His whistleblower documentation of politically motivated White House editing and censorship of climate science program reports intended for the public and Congress received front page coverage in the New York Times and was widely reported in the media, including on EcoTalk, my show on Air America. Rick, great to talk to you again. We last spoke in an interview format in 2007. That was 5 years ago. Welcome to the Green Front on the Progressive Radio Network, and want to talk to you first about what's happening in Rio and then look at how far we've come or perhaps regressed in terms of action and policy to address climate change.
Hey, hello again, Betsy. It's been a while.
That was a long introduction. Dee, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, how you doing?
Great to have you both on. Let's just first start with the news from Rio. Already, and today is the first day of the summit, getting reports out that there's been some weak text passed, and there's already disappointment on the part of environmentalists. Folks there are blaming it on the preoccupation with the global economy and election here in this country and all kinds of other challenges. But yet, if we continue to ignore climate change, just to mention one of the many eco-challenges we face, the biggest one, we will, you know, only be in bigger trouble down the road. Rick, what's your take on what's happening so far based on monitoring from your perch in D.C.?
Well, if you measure what appears to be in the text that will be adopted in Rio against what really needs to happen for equitable, sustainable development, dealing with the climate change problem and other fundamental issues, it has to be seen as a huge disappointment. Although I think that expectations for any really major new developments going into this were low enough that I'm not sure whether disappointment is exactly the right word, but I'm reminded, you know, this is Rio plus 20. There were the original Earths in Rio 1992 is where they adopted the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Foundational Climate Treaty, and made other agreements. But I remember at that time sitting in a meeting in the State Department, kind of as a fly on the wall, where the first Bush administration State Department negotiator was meeting with some of the the Bush administration's business constituents, and he said, well, we have to come out of this Earth Summit looking like we're in a position of leadership on climate change. We're going into the election campaign. We can't look like we're defaulting. But we think we have a way of coming up with some text that will make us look like leaders, but create a process that will tie things up for years where we don't actually have to do anything. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think that sort of encapsulates we're getting language now that keeps a process going, but doesn't really require anybody to do anything much in particular. So I think that if we're going to get real progress, I mean, we need the high-level political leadership from governments, but something needs to be happening more from the bottom up, from civil society, from the grassroots, from innovative entrepreneurs to make things happen and create this pressure, because we are certainly not there now.
In fact, there's a word that the European Union's climate commissioner just tweeted that the text has, quote, too much take note and reaffirm and too little decide and commit.
That's it.
She said the big task now for UN nations is to follow up. And it just seems like we keep, kicking the ball down the road. And yet we're seeing it come back and hit us in the face. What do you think of all these extreme weather events currently on the first day of summer? We have fires burning. I heard one report that said they're not going to be fully out until possibly fall. And here it is only the first day of summer.
Well, this is a big story. I mean, you have the largest wildfire in New Mexico history. What is it, 500 square miles burned now, and the second largest in Colorado history, and you have, Texas and so forth. And last year you had extraordinary record-breaking, something like 20,000 wildfires in Texas. It's interesting that people will, the media will talk about this being the second warmest May on record, and then they'll cover the wildfires, but they don't seem to connect the wildfires with climate change. And it seems to me that climate change is a factor. Really, I mean, they'll say, well, you can't attribute any one specific meteorological event to climate change. And that's just really the wrong framing. I mean, basically, anthropogenic climate change is embedded in all of the weather now that we're having. And it's feeding these wildfires just as it would be expected to. I mean, there's hotter, drier conditions. There has been a severe drought in all of these areas where they're having the major wildfires. You have longer fire seasons. The snowpack is melting earlier, and that's what kind of kicks off the start of the fire season. You've got the mountain pine beetle eating up forests, moving northward, creating a lot of dead vegetation for fires to feed on. I mean, I don't think you can adequately put the wildfire problem in perspective without talking about climate change. I think the leading climate scientists will tell you that.
And why do you think the media doesn't connect the dots? Do you think it's a dynamic of fear? I was watching an interview a few days ago with Joseph Williams of Politico, where he noted that reporters are afraid to state obvious facts because they're concerned about specific interests, and he meant interests from the right going after them and attacking these reporters. Do you think that there is just a sense in the newsrooms that if we say specifically this is being caused by the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, that they're going to be bombarded by hateful emails and they don't want to deal with that?
I think that clearly is an element of it. I mean, the climate change, climate disruption problem, you know, is big and complicated. It's hard to get your arms around to try to understand the science. It would be tough enough to analyze if everybody were being intelligent and knowledgeable and public-spirited and scientifically literate. But when you have ideological interests who are afraid that this implies more government intervention, you have powerful corporate interests ripping through the public discourse like shrapnel, it does kind of poison the well. It makes, to mix metaphors, it makes it more difficult. And I think in the media, you also have, you have such cutbacks in print journalism, you have environmental and science, people who really have the institutional memory for how to cover these issues like real pros, kind of attenuating. You have people covering issues who don't really understand this stuff very well. So there is a path of least resistance to avoid it and still say you're covering your story or to do some kind of fake balance. But I do think that there's an anticipatory self-censorship, you might call it, whether they're getting an explicit signal from above or whether they can just read the signals to avoid controversy, because the global warming denial machine, and I'm not talking about legitimate skeptics, I'm talking about the politically orchestrated right-wing attack now, will get all over people, whether it's in the blogosphere or whether it's shutting down the whole discourse at the level of Congress. Even the president won't talk about climate change. You know, it's sort of like the path of least resistance is avoidance now, which is very concerning.
Well, couldn't agree with you more. Great comments, great insights. And I would add to that, because I've been hitting the green ceiling, as I call it, trying to get, you know, radio syndicators to run an environmentally themed program for the last 15 years, first with my network CBS. Was on Air America. They didn't support the show, meaning they didn't pay for it or promote it, but we still managed to get 50,000 listeners a night and move from a weekly to a daily slot. So that really speaks to the fact that there is a pent-up need out there for, you know, environmentally minded people. And of course, we'd have a lot more of those green-minded citizens if we connected the dots for more of them, and if they got that from the media. So that's the, you know, the catch-22. But I've been told, this is important to publicize, by, you know, the head of Clear Channel programming, Westwood One, you know, and a couple of other smaller syndicators, that because of the dominance of the ultra-conservative, you know, radio talk shows, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck at the time, Sean Hannity, there's no room for a green show. And I said, well, you know, if you guys love controversy and if this somehow is seen as controversial and political, that's part of the problem, put me on there. You know, I'll take them on. Oh, no, we can't do that. I said, how about the weekends? No, it's just it's hostile territory out there. So because of, you know, the success of the right-wingers, they're blocking out, you know, a show that, you know, or shows like mine that could actually make a difference here. And if we're not using mainstream media outlets, you know, for the biggest, you know, planetary crisis of our time, you know, what the hell are we using them for? And, of course, if you turn on TV, there's lots of reality shows. I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? Kind of a surreal moment in our nation's history.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I think at the level of the power elite, the highest level of political people and the corporate elite, they know better. I mean, they're not stupid. They can see what the National Academy of Sciences is saying. They know what's coming out of the IPCC. They're not ignorant of science, but their interest at stake. Their interest at stake. They don't want to move to a system that takes away the use of their product. It cuts into their market share unless they completely control it. I suppose when the corporate power goes to the politicians and says, look, we figured out a way to make more money doing sustainable energy, then the science denialism will tend to go away. You have a culture war going on as well, the antagonism toward liberal elites and toward progressive values and toward activist government, and it leads to all this skirmishing in the media, in the blogosphere, among in election campaigns, and kind of out in the streets, you know, among the 99%, as it were. And it's kind of useful, I think, to people in the 1% who are really controlling the strategic decisions, to have people divided among themselves, because it keeps the focus off people, putting pressure on them to really bring about major changes. So I think, I mean, Jim Hansen referred to the global warming denialists as the court jesters out there in front, but it was the real power interests behind them that were the danger and who tended to escape people's notice.
Speaking of politics and the influence of the right, are you concerned that if Mitt Romney is elected, he will continue the ignoble tradition of George W. Bush of censoring science, considering the fact that he seems to be bringing the old Bush team back in terms of foreign policy? You do have to wonder if he's going to bring the team back in terms of domestic policy, and considering he has, you know, coal lobbyists and what have you in his energy sector, energy circle of consultants. You do have to wonder, do you not, that he is once again going to continue that effort to sort of downplay science, ignore science, and attack anybody who points out scientific facts?
Well, one sort of has to wonder exactly what his core beliefs are politically. He seems very susceptible to pressure from the right and from the corporate interests. With the Bush administration, the most recent Bush administration, we saw a willingness to spin the science and misrepresent it and suppress or communication or ignore reports or whatever it took to conform the scientific message as it came through official channels to the policy. And the policy was not to regulate greenhouse gases, not to challenge the energy interests that the administration was very close to. If it involved manipulating congressional testimony or letting a report stay in the boxes rather than putting it out, you know, or telling suppressing a national climate assessment or doctoring reports or whatever, closing down websites and intimidating scientists, whatever it took, whether this would be replicated under a Romney administration, It's an interesting question. It's a good question. One would have to be concerned about it, and one would have to be watchdogging that thing very, very closely from day one. And we would use our inside connections to try to monitor what was happening during the transition and beyond. With the Obama administration, we don't see quite the same problem of egregious censorship. There have been a few questionable instances, but sometimes it seems to take the tendency of setting science aside when it's politically inconvenient, if it involves permitting our offshore oil drilling in the Arctic or delaying the smog rule until after the election and so forth. But I think there would be a difference with the Romney administration. And certainly, I mean, the Clinton administration, it can be subjected to heavy criticism, but when the Bush-Cheney administration came in, we were dealing with a real different animal there in terms of how they operated vis-a-vis science. So, yeah, you might expect something to change.
Well, there was a great speech yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, Rick, but DR and I really are hopeful, cautiously optimistic that it might make a difference. Senator John Kerry, I couldn't tell if anyone was in the room, but it was a stirring 54-minute call to action on climate change in which he quoted Thomas Paine as having said, "It is an affront to treat falsehood with complacence," he says, and went on to say, "Yet when it comes to climate change, the falsehood of today's naysayers is only matched by the complacency, the indifference of our political system. It is well past the time to heed Thomas Paine's admonition and reaffirm the commitment first made by President George Herbert Walker Bush. As a matter of conscience and common sense, we should be fighting today's insidious conspiracy of silence on climate change, a silence that empowers misinformation and mythology to grow where science and truth should prevail." Fabulous speech. Did you happen to see it? If not, I recommend it. We're going to put a link
website. But I read it, and I thought it was very strong, and we're going to post it on climatesciencewatch.org this afternoon. People really need to see that. It's really one of the strongest thing I've seen on the floor of Congress in ages on this. It's so often the other side that will grab the floor and go on and on, Senator Inhofe most notably, and only rarely do people who take climate science seriously and the need for a climate policy really get up there and, you know, grab attention. And Kerry's remarks were right on target. And he's been on this for a long time. I mean, he's legitimate. He's not just grandstanding there. I remember when Al Gore was still a senator, I mean, in the early beginning of the 90s, and he chaired a science subcommittee, and he had hearing after hearing about oh gosh, oceans and clouds and carbon climate models and carbon dioxide economics, and he would listen to the expert for hours and hours, and he really was a student of the subject and really was mastering it. You never see senators do. I mean,
okay.
You never see it. And Kerry was the only one who would sit there with Gore and listen to this stuff.
And that was back in 1988.
Of being serious about this issue.
Absolutely. So here's the question. I know you want, it's your turn, DR, but I've got to ask you, Rick. Why is it, as I'm watching, you know, John Kerry, you know, just stirring words, and it was delivered so eloquently and passionately with just the right amount of, you know, scientific fact, you know, statistics, outrage, moral outrage, and call to action. I'm thinking, you know, who is this guy? Let's get him to be president. Oh, well, we already had a chance with him, and same with Al Gore. Why do these two men who do get it, who have gotten it for decades, since, you know, last century, get seemingly relatively muzzled while they're running for president?
Well, you tell me. I mean, that is a real good question, because those campaigns were far from as being as effective as they could have been, although arguably Gore actually won his election.
Exactly, especially
and
because
also,
they were
also,
so close.
Also, if you take a look at what happened in Ohio, you might almost argue that Kerry won his election. But leaving that whole question aside is a separate topic.
If they had used the green card, what if it had made a difference? You know, that's what really, you know, gets me.
Well, you know, that and also, you know, the kinds of issues that have been raised by say, Occupy Wall Street, the radical inequality, the growing concentration of power at the top. Kerry and Gore, you know, they were sort of very high-minded liberals on environment and technology policy and a number of other things, but they didn't really go after that more populist type of consciousness either. And so I think they let too much of the Democratic base slip away from them by the Democrats in general not really having that part of the agenda framed. And I still think they don't. So I think there are multiple reasons, but gosh, I mean, watching those campaigns, the substance of the candidates was on the whole pretty good, and the campaigns were just so ineffective.
I just want to observe that if you haven't had a chance to read it, Kerry's book, This Moment on Earth, which came out about 5 years ago, is one of the best environmental books I've ever read. You are right. He has a full command of this and has had one for years, and it is a shame. And I'm embarrassed to admit I voted for the other guy, but looking back, it's a shame that he did not.
Never again.
Never again.
Now that you know what you know, you woke up and smelled the carbon, DR.
Yes.
Well, that was back. I had John Kerry on my show, Eco Talk on Air America, as well as you, Rick. That was in 2007. You said in an email that you were doing the interview with me as you were in Sundance with the debut of Everything's Cool, a film that was done by Judith Helfand and her partner. Fabulous film. You were in it. And, you know, what do we need to do to really get, you know, media like that, media like this, out to the mainstream American public? Because I still feel like we're in a silo. I still feel like we, meaning those of us who are environmentally tuned in and losing sleep at night about the urgency of climate change and other related challenges and crises, you know, that we're still just a minority of the population, or so it seems.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't characterize myself as a media expert, but one thing that occurs to me, and perhaps it's from just having attended the Netroots Nation 2012 annual gathering up in Providence a week before last, whether it involves the difficulty and the dysfunction around making progress on environmental issues or a wide range of other problems of society, they have all been, I mean, they may be in silos in terms of how they're being talked about, but really they're all swept up into a larger battle about what kind of country we are going to be, what direction we're going to move in as a people, what kind of government do we want to have effective government, There is a rightward tilt to the playing field on that right now, I think. And there is a very concentrated control of power over strategic decisions. Sometimes I think see government, except for the national security state, almost being middle management to corporate interests. And they certainly don't push anything beyond what corporate power will accept. And somehow we need to make links among the grassroots interests in a wide range of issues so that they're mutually supportive. And you can't say, well, poverty, that's someone else's issue. Or the people who work on health care say, well, environment, that's someone else's issue. Because there's a system at work here that's blocking progress on a whole host of issues. And until the grassroots are a little more interconnected in how they work together and in how they talk about and analyze these issues, I think that it's too easy to pit people against each other.
Or as Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will.
I would say so.
And the International Energy Association says that we need to end government subsidies for fossil fuels, beginning in this country, and yet that Twitter campaign seems to not have gotten that as far as it needs to go based on what's happening. I think, was there action taken on that in Rio yet, Rick, do you know?
I would be extremely surprised if there was any strong language on an agreement to end subsidies for fossil fuels. I think there would almost inevitably be some kind of hedging language that would say, yet affirming and taking note of the fact that different countries have different imperatives with respect to the development of their energy resources, or some sort of wiggle room that doesn't really commit anybody to do anything specifically. There is a bill that's been introduced in Congress. Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Ellison in the House, that would eliminate systematically all the fossil fuel subsidies. It's $110 billion over 10 years. There's a lot of subsidies built into the system in the U.S., but, I mean, you know the situation on the Hill right now. The bill makes good talking points, but it's hardly likely to be moved forward under the current circumstances.
I see here it says from Rio, the draft text omitted a clause calling for governments to phase out fossil fuel subsidies, which have nearly tripled since 2009, despite a pledge by G20 countries to eliminate them. Phasing out fossil fuels by 2020 would reduce annual global energy demand by 5% and carbon dioxide emissions by nearly 6%. That's according to the IEA. Here we are again with a major world summit underway, and on the first day that it's officially open, already expectations, are diminished, and it's being, almost dismissed as, not going to change anything. It's a pattern. It's very disturbing.
Yes.
Rick, I don't know if you had a chance to hear it, but last Friday, Bill McKibben was on NPR, being interviewed for the NPR show On Point, and he noted that the strategy for American climate activists needs to be, instead of trying to confront the politicians, the idea should be to confront the fossil fuel interests, and once the fossil fuel interests can be made to understand the dangers, only then will the politics shift in favor of renewable energy and putting a price on carbon. Did you have a chance to hear that interview, and if so, what do you make of McKibben's argument?
Well, I did not hear that interview yet, although I did hear him speak at Netroots Nation, making those points in a panel on the activism to try to stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. And Bill, by the way, plays a big role in that film, Everything's Cool, that I was in. And you can get that thing on Amazon and Netflix. It's interesting. Captured a particular moment, I think, in our history. Bill says essentially what we've learned, and this seeming victory on the Keystone pipeline may be very temporary, and that pipeline may very well go through, and Obama may sign off on it after the election, say. But the climate movement has learned that it is dealing with corporate power, some of the most powerful and wealthiest interests on the planet, and they don't like to be challenged, and they don't like to lose, and that in terms of making progress politically, it is going to be necessary for the grassroots to come together and find a way to weaken the political power of the fossil fuel industry. That's the sort of a strategic challenge that he framed.
I think we're running out of time. I could talk to you all day. I'm sure DR has a final question, too. But just wanted to ask you, Rick, to tell us what your focus is right now at this juncture where it seems everything is on the line, just in terms of climate change action, and things are getting obfuscated. And it's, you know, both frustrating and also, I don't know, sometimes I say to my husband, well, the bad news is the good news, honey. Things are really reaching critical mass, or maybe mess, and that's got to be good news for those of us who are trying to make a living, you know, educating and doing outreach and, you know, offering solutions to these crises.
Well,
am I delusional?
an important part of our particular niche in this grand division of labor that we're all involved in trying to move things forward is an inside the beltway, a focus, trying to report to people what's going on here in Washington with Congress, with the administration, the White House, the federal agencies. There was a House hearing yesterday in which EPA's regulation of greenhouse gases got pounded by a bunch of business interests. We'll have a report on that and Kerry's speech and so forth. And going up against the global warming denial machine, calling out people who are contributing to this unfortunate disconnect between what's coming out of this climate science world and what's coming out of the policy world. Where we'll be after the election, we'll just have to see. We may have to have a strong focus on bringing whistleblowers out of the woodwork to let us know what's going on.
If anyone could recognize that, Rick, that would be you.
My project is sponsored by the Government Accountability Project here, which is the foremost whistleblower council and advocacy organization, whistleblower.org. And so we're always alert to those issues as well.
DR?
Rick, I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us, and I definitely appreciate speaking to you. I watched some of your old interviews on 60 Minutes and in other venues, and what always comes through is just your deep reservoir of courage. Your courage is as strong as the problem is great. So it's just an honor and a pleasure to speak to you.
I echo that. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick Pilz
is the founder and director of Climate Science Watch. It's a wonderful nonprofit public interest advocacy project. Just knowing they're there and holding public officials accountable for using climate research with integrity and effectiveness gives me a little better night's sleep. So, Rick, we'll follow up with you. I really am glad to reconnect, and there's a lot to talk about, a lot more we could talk about. So next time. And next segment, we're going to be speaking with John Rogers. He's with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Stay tuned. You're going to find out what are the most impactful things you can do to change your daily routine to have a lighter eco footprint. We'll be right back. We just come together. We can